And then I'd like to welcome everyone who's come here today. The subject for the talk, the title is Meaning in Myth. And this is quite a popular subject for people to be thinking of in current times, in recent times, the whole reemergence of an understanding of the myth and what its usefulness is, what its place in our culture, in our way of thinking, that is becoming more and more developed and looked at and understood. Oftentimes within our ordinary pattern of speech, in our ordinary use of speech in English, that we take the word a myth to mean something which is false or untrue, something which is like a fabulous tale. And so to, in a way, use it to indicate something which is unreal or untrue. And it's quite common to say, oh, that's a myth. Or even in literature, in book titles, books such as The Myth of Mental Illness or The Myth of Freedom, that these are using the word to indicate that this is not real, or this idea of freedom or this idea of mental illness is not a truth, is not real. But if we actually look at what we mean by a myth, we can see that it is, in its original purpose, it wasn't actually just pointing to something which is fanciful or untrue or unreal, but it's more like something which is symbolic. Actually, when I was thinking about this talk and what I might speak about, I remember one of the things my mother used to say to me when I was very small, which is she'd say, "What is a myth?" And then you'd say, "I don't know." So a myth is a lady moth. That was the first thing that came into my mind when I was thinking about the subject. But I think I'll avoid that, skirt around that particular one. So what you have with a myth or a mythical tale, a story, is something which it's not necessarily aiming to be factual or historical. It's something which is portraying an archetype, portraying some common experience of humanity, some common experience of our mind. And so that, in a way, it's not intended, it's not necessary for it to be historically accurate in order for a myth to be something which is useful and meaningful and helpful to us. In any kind of, say, particularly in religious scripture or in looking at legends and mythical tales, you can see that there's a number of different strands involved there. So that there's the aspect of an archetype, like a picture, an image which is being portrayed of a common experience. And there's a historical aspect, like the events that actually happened, things that actually happened, say, if a person like Odysseus really lived, or what events really occurred in the life of Jesus Christ or the Buddha. So there's an archetypal aspect, a historical aspect, and then the psychological, you know, how that same pattern is represented in our own mind, how the events of the life of the Buddha or the events of a particular legend or story, such a tale, matches our own experience. What does it say about our own psyche, our own mind? And so you have these through any kind of tale, any kind of religious scripture or such like form. You have these three different strands are involved. So that I think this is something that has particularly in modern times, where the with the arising of analytical study, with people, historians, theologians, archaeologists, anthropologists, searching for a sense of truth, and what is true, what is real in terms of what can be historically verified. And that, you know, if you can't pin it down to a certain time, a certain date, then it's not true, or it's to be discarded. And yet, I think this is taking it two things too literally, because even if you can prove that it was impossible that, say, the Buddha was enlightened under that particular kind of tree, or it's impossible to prove that Jesus was born on the 25th of December, or that Jesus existed at all, still there can be some usefulness within the story, within that portrayal, because it can match experiences common to human beings, and you realize that why myths, why stories such as these are carried along through time. We remember them. We remember them because they have meaning for us. They are symbolic of aspects of our own nature. Why we remember myths, then, is for that particular purpose. Because to remember a story, to remember events from things from the remote past, they give us an inroad, an access point to our own mind. They actually are pointing to experiences of our own life, and that by making them conscious, by portraying those events, those triumphs and those crises, the comedies and the tragedies of heroes and villains in history, we can see the events of our own mind occurring. And it's by making things conscious, by bringing them into our mind, that we can begin to objectify them, understand them, and learn to harmonize with them. I found an interesting fact a little while ago that apparently, if there's any historians, they can probably correct me, but I heard that in Greece, the Greek theater, which had strong religious connotations, the theaters and the hospitals were always built close to each other. That physical health was very closely related to the use of the theater, which wasn't just like entertainment, but the Greek drama, the comedies and tragedies that were portrayed in Greek drama, were there as basically mental hospitals, as a way of helping to understand and balance out our mental life. And this is very much what one can understand the use of myth and this and legendary stories, legendary tales. It can be used as a way of understanding our own life in a much more direct and complete way. Now, to maybe give some examples, then we can see that because we're in a very multicultural society now, we're living say in contact with a whole different variety of influences, that we're surrounded by different stories, different tales, and we have access to ones that not only come from our European background, if we're Europeans, or our Asian background, if we're Asians, but we live in the middle of a whole confluence of different influences. You can see that there are fundamental human questions or fundamental human problems or qualities that all over the world, different traditions, different groups have evolved stories and ideas to help symbolize and help bring them into consciousness. Wherever humanity has appeared, one of the questions that has always arisen is how did we get here? How did we get here? Not sort of, which road did you take to arrive at Amaravati, but how did humanity appear? How did the world appear? What made the cosmos happen? And so that everywhere you go in the world, every culture has its own creation myth, its own stories of creation, how the universe came into being. And so that you find that that myth appears in many different forms around the world. The other basic, one of the other basic questions that we have as human beings is, if even if we've got some sort of idea of how and why we got here, then the next question is, what am I supposed to do? Okay, now we're here. What happens next? What do I do with my life? What is the direction to go? So, say from Christian tradition, you have the creation story, the creation tale of Genesis. In the Judaic and Christian tradition, you've got the story of God creating the world. Somebody sent me a postcard a couple of days ago from Israel saying, I think it's 5,762 years ago, God said, "Let there be light." Happy New Year. And that's a very nice way to put it. And so that, you know, in a sense, scientists or historians can say, well, look, it's absolutely ridiculous. There's no way that the universe could have been created 5,762 years ago. We can easily prove that that wasn't how it was. One can say, discard such a story as being ridiculous. Just as you know, any other aspect of scripture, in that way you can dissect it, take it apart, say that it's all been put together from a variety of sources, and therefore it's invalid or it's unimportant. But then, rather than looking at it in that way, the whole use of a myth or a story is to use it reflectively. It works on the intuitive level. So then and to compare that then with the Buddhist tradition, you have the story of the creation in the biblical tradition. In the Buddhist tradition, the Buddha avoided, he didn't make that kind of story prominent. He's one of the few religious teachers that didn't make very much of a creation story in that way. He said that the ultimate beginning of things is fundamentally inconceivable, imponderable, one of the unknowable things, which doesn't mean to say that he didn't know, or it's not knowable, but just that this is something that cannot be put into thought, that the thinking mind cannot conceive. And the whole way that we see the universe in terms of human-centered perceptions and time and space, you know, that is restricting our whole quality of vision. So the Buddha said, don't bother trying to think and figure out how it all began. He actually said, if you try to, you'll either go crazy or your head will explode into 7 pieces, actually. So he avoided that, say, as talking about the ultimate beginning of things. But then in other places, he said, well, if you want to know how it happens, how a universe comes into being at the start of an eon, then how a universe arises. And he describes that, how different beings arise in the high heavenly realms, and then they, as time goes by, they appear in lower and lower realms, and the physical world appears and then reaches the point of degeneration. The universe reaches its fullest extent, and then it starts to collapse again. It calls a period of universal expansion, a period of universal contraction, which actually matches the scientific model quite well of a big bang and then a big crunch. But the Buddha, I find it quite marvelous how he said, well, this is just the way a universe happens, but you know, this isn't really important. This is not the central feature, because what the Buddha was trying to point to was that it's not a matter of how it all began in the first place, or to develop a universal picture of it, but to recognize how our perceptions of the world arise, how our experience of the world arises, so that his approach brings it more inside, brings it into our own personal experience, so that what you have in the Buddhist approach, the Buddha talks about the genesis of problems, how our problems arise, how our experience of separateness, how our difficulties in life arise. So that rather than an average kind of creation myth in Buddhism, you have the Buddha teaching what's called dependent origination, which is how we experience, how it comes that we experience dissatisfaction or unhappiness. Now, it's an interesting thing that you can look at the biblical myth, the Judaic myth of the creation of the world in 7 days, and look at dependent origination, where the Buddha describes how ignorance is the cause of not understanding the truth of things is the cause of alienation and dissatisfaction, and how from ignorance the separation of mind and body, of self and other, occurs, how the attachment to the senses becomes solidified, how sense contact and the feelings of pleasure and pain become something that we absorb into and attach to, so that we run away from pain or we chase after pleasure, and the mind becomes caught up with desire of one sort or another, and that attaching to that desire then causes us to invest in trying to possess the beautiful and escape the painful. And then when the beautiful slips through our fingers or the painful catches up with us, then that's when we experience, this is what we call suffering or dukkha. And that it's an interesting thing. It struck me a number of years ago how actually that model matches very much the story that you have in Genesis. Because just as from the Buddhist point of view, you have ignorance and desire being the cause of suffering and alienation, what you've got portrayed in the Judaic myth is pretty much the same sort of thing. That in the beginning, God creates the heaven and the earth. But out of that sort of primordial existence, basic existence, everything is fine. And all the earth has been created, and the animals and the human beings have been created, and Adam and Eve are there in the garden, and everything's fine. And this corresponds in the cycle of dependent origination, like the creation, the arising of consciousness, the separation of mind and body, and the sensory world and feeling. And everything's fine up to the level of feeling, but then from the level of feeling, desire arises, then trouble begins. This is where the serpent appears on the scene in the Garden of Eden, where rather than just living in the garden and experiencing simple pleasure and simple pain and not making anything out of it, then the serpent appears. And this is, in a way, the spirit of desire. And so then when Adam and Eve follow that desire and get caught into that, then the result is that God appears and says, you know, you've done a terrible wrong. I told you shouldn't eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Now you have to go. And then they're sent out of Eden. They're cast out from their original homeland, their sense of original comfort and contentment. So in the same way, in the Paticca-Samuppada, the dependent origination, once feeling turns into desire, desire turns into attachment, pretty soon you've been expelled from the garden. And just like Adam and Eve, you're stuck out in the raw world, feeling separation from your home, separation from what is good and comforting, and at struggle in a situation, a condition of struggle with life. So now you might think this is all completely ridiculous, but you can also see that these are ways that you can understand, say, that in the Judaic Christian tradition, they're talking about the arising of suffering. Why is there suffering in the world? Why is there suffering in the world? And they have the story of Adam and Eve and the serpent to describe that, whereas the Buddha brought it back down to much more kind of psychological concepts. The other the other of the two questions that came to mind of where do we go from here, or what do we do in Christianity? The central myth of Christianity is the crucifixion and the resurrection. That's like the crucial point of the life of Christ and the main symbol. And that's why the cross is always used in Christianity as like their basic central image of the crucifixion. And the scientists and the theologians and the historians have a great time taking apart the crucifixion and the resurrection. You know, it's completely unprovable. But it's much more significant if you think of it in terms of what is this symbolizing? What is this talking about? In Buddhism, this would parallel the Buddha's enlightenment, the liberation of the Buddha, the experience under the Bodhi tree. And just as the crucifixion and the resurrection for Jesus was very much like the complete, through the experience of complete suffering, persecution, humiliation, then the sense of the self, the ego, is completely transfixed and pinned down and had to be completely transcended for the resurrection, for salvation to occur. But the self or the ego had to die completely for the Christ consciousness to be liberated. Then in the way you have in the Buddhist scriptures, the Buddha's enlightenment under the Bodhi tree being assaulted by the hordes of Mara. This is talking about the same process whereby our salvation, you have the Buddha being attacked by the forces of fear and the forces of desire, and then the forces of duty. That's first attacked by an army of demons, and then the daughters of Mara trying to seduce him, and then the images of his family, his old father, trying to call him back to Kapilavatthu to take over the throne, to look after the kingdom. Yeah. And so in that way, you have the Buddha being tested by the forces of fear, desire, and duty. And in the same way, these are pointing to experiences within our own everyday life, that the Buddha symbolizes the mind in us, which is awake, which is pure, which is aware, and that is constantly being assaulted by the hordes of Mara in sort of delicate and maybe not so graphic ways. But certainly we are assailed by feelings of fear, feelings of desire, of feelings of responsibility, duty. And just like the Buddha, the only way that we can respond to that is to sit and be unmoving under the Bodhi tree and say, "I know you, Mara." And that is what causes Mara to be unable to harm the Buddha, to damage the Buddha in any way, is that sense of recognition and awareness. And just as Jesus on the cross, it's only when he completely surrenders, there's a quality of a complete surrender, then he lifts up his head and says, "It is finished." Now, in the one can take a myth, a story, take these things in many different ways, and it's always up to each individual to see how these different images affect us. But in a way, it's because these are talking about deep and complex aspects of our own mind, our own being, that in a way the patterns help us and guide us, even if we conceptually can't necessarily follow it or put it together. That it's in a way pointing directions for us or telling us what to expect in many different ways. Like another of the most famous and powerful myths in our time is that like I mentioned before, the story of Odysseus, the return of Odysseus back from the Trojan Wars, going home. And this is something that James Joyce picked up on in his book Ulysses, and he portrayed it as a wild night in Dublin in 1904. But in the same way, he was trying to take what is a universal symbol and put it into a context of ordinary everyday life, saying, you know, this kind of story, this kind of representation is talking about you and me and the events of our own life, our own mind. Same as George Bernard Shaw's book Pygmalion, about a man, Professor Higgins, falling in love with his creation, a Cockney girl who he trains to be behave like a duchess, speak like a duchess. In the same way, the story of Odysseus, you can see that in a powerful religious symbol, because in many ways our religious life, spiritual life, is built around the sense of longing for home that we feel like Adam and Eve. We're outside the garden. We've been chucked out. We feel separate from people. We feel uncertain of ourselves. We feel insecure. We have a sense of longing. We long for security. We long for comfort. We long for that feeling of, we're home. That's like coming home after a long journey or being away on holiday. Just that feeling of getting back to your home after work. It's that same heartfelt quality that is used in this story of just, safe, we're home, good, this is good. And that is, in a way, a religious symbol, because as the Buddha used very homely and tangible examples in his teaching, in the same way that the quality of coming home can refer to a spiritual homecoming, like a realization of the true nature of things, of the true reality of what we are. And that that quality of being pulled, being drawn, that quality of longing for home is in a way like the spiritual longing that we have for communion, for union, for unity, for completeness, for fulfillment. And it's interesting in the story of Odysseus how it takes him 10 years to make what is, if you look at it on the map, a journey that should have taken him just a few weeks or a few months. But he's drawn in by all kinds of events, both painful and beautiful, marvelous, being attacked and imprisoned, or being distracted, seduced, being shipwrecked, and so forth. And that when looking at that, the trials of his journey, you can, and comparing that with your own spiritual life, you can say, well, yes, that's what it's like. You know, sometimes you're beaten up by some angry god and shipwrecked and said to just let loose to float in the ocean. But it's also interesting that Odysseus had Athene, the goddess of wisdom, as his protector, his mentor, and she was always there looking out for him and making sure that even if everything else fell apart, you know, she was still going to help him. And then just looking at the different events of his journey. Actually, it was about a 10-year journey. 7 years of that was spent in the company of an island of nymphs. I think it was it Calisto? Calypso. Calypso, who fell madly in love with Odysseus, and he lived with her for 7 years, and it was this blissful existence on this lovely Mediterranean island surrounded by these beautiful people, and an idyllic, dream-like existence. But after 7 years of this, Odysseus again feels in his heart, I want to go home. This is all very lovely, but this isn't home. I want to go home. I want to return to Ithaca. And so I won't go into all the other aspects of the story, but being trapped by Polyphemus, the Cyclops, and being caught between Scylla and Charybdis, the sea monster and the great whirlpool. These are all representing the trials and difficulties of our spiritual development. Everything goes wrong when we feel attacked and oppressed. Ajahn Sajito once compared the journey of Odysseus and his sailors past the sirens. He says, this is what it's like. This is the sirens represent the desire mind. And so they knew that the only way they could get past the sirens was if one of them could hear the siren song and not follow them, because the sailors would hear the sirens singing their beautiful, intoxicating, entrancing song, and then would go and land on the shore of their island, and then these beautiful sea nymphs would then turn into monsters and devour the sailors. So Ajahn Sajito was commenting one day how that this is very much what like the spiritual friends are like Odysseus's crew, and they tied him to the mast. They filled their ears with wax so they couldn't hear the song. Then they tied him to the mast and then rowed past the island of the sirens, and the sirens are calling to him, singing, and Odysseus is straining at his ropes, trying to break free, and the crew is just kind of rowing. And he's yelling at his crew, saying, "Come on, it's all right, lads. Change of plan." You know. Honestly, you know, I'm sure this is going to be all right. I have absolutely no doubt whatsoever. You know, come on, be reasonable, untie me. And the crew are just kind of hauling away. And this is like the five precepts. And the crew is like the bonds, are like the ropes, are like the five precepts. And the crew is like the five indriya, faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, wisdom. These are our spiritual powers. They're the things that power us through. And even though the desire, the fragile mind is tied to the mast and screaming, this is rather what it feels like being on a meditation retreat sometimes. Those of you who just come off 10 days with Ajahn Sumedho probably can resonate with this. You feel like you're tied, strapped to the mast and screaming to be let out. But it's only by just being patient and letting the spiritual powers carry you through that you actually get past the sirens. And then the sirens, of course, then when they got past, then they were furious, and that they'd been defeated, and the sea opens up and swallows them, and they're defeated. So what that represents is how, you know, we do have the ability, if we have good friends and the right powers at our disposal, that we can get through the most intoxicating, bedazzling, entrancing pulls upon our mind, upon our heart. It's also an interesting thing of the story of Odysseus, how when he arrives back at Ithaca, he's actually asleep. That he's carried there by some friendly nearby islanders. He's totally exhausted by this time, and they pick him up and they carry him to Ithaca. And when he arrives at Ithaca, then Athene puts a kind of haze around his eyes so that he can't recognize where he is at first, because they know, even though all the way through the story you have Odysseus referred to as noble, long-suffering, cunning Odysseus. That's his sort of his title. But she realizes once if he wakes up on the beach in Ithaca, he's going to really lose control. He's going to be so happy he's going to get shot, because he's been away for 20 years and things have changed while he's been away. So she puts a haze over his eyes so he can't recognize where he is at first, and then he discovers slowly that the island has been taken over by people who are suitors trying to marry his queen Penelope. And so then he has to work his way. He has to then meet up with his son Telemachus and other friends to band together and to plot how they're going to do the suitors in to regain his throne. And then they do this, and he's recognized by his dog. His hound recognizes him, and he's so pleased to see him. The dog has waited and stayed alive until Odysseus came home. The dog sees him and recognizes him, and then lies down and dies. And his old nurse, recognizes him. And then he sees that many of his old servants and friends have turned against him and are now just helping the suitors and trying to get the most they can out of the land. But some others, like I think it's Eumaeus, his swineherd, is still faithful and still looking after the pigs. And Odysseus, in his disguise as an old man, goes and stays with Eumaeus, the swineherd. And they sit there and they talk through the evening. And then he's really impressed, because even though it's late at night and it's dark and it's cold, Eumaeus says, "Oh, I've got to go out and look after the pigs. You know, I shouldn't just stay in here chatting." And I have to go and take care of the pigs, and so that it's only those who are faithful, or those who are kind of humble and simple, that recognize Odysseus. And then finally they band together, and I won't go into the details, but of course all the suitors get killed, and in this very gory finale. And then Odysseus resumes his throne. And so thinking about this one day some years ago, I happened to be reading the Odyssey, and it struck me that it's rather like the stages of enlightenment. It's like being on the path. It's like when Odysseus left Troy and wanted to go home, this was like the entry onto the spiritual path. And that the whole story unfolds as a spiritual analogy. And that arriving at Ithaca, it's like he's home, but there's still danger. He still hasn't completed the picture. And this is rather like, say, the third level of enlightenment, like what they call anagami, like non-returner. He's home, but there's still work to be done. And so that the main opponent, or the main obstacle to regaining the throne, is what is called asmimana, or the conceit of identity. And so that's the final battle, is that even when you've developed enormous virtue and enormous clarity of mind and purity of heart, and you're home, you're on your homeland, you're back in Ithaca, if you don't deal with the sense of self, with the conceit of identity in a very clever way, and you are just incautious, then you're going to end up getting skewered by the sense of I, and you're never going to make it back to your throne, to being, like, I mean, as a symbol, like the king back on the throne of his rightful kingdom, with the country at peace and in harmony with things. And so that it struck me that was very much like the final battle of the spiritual life, is this, the last of the three, what's called the ten fetters, the three last, asmimana, avijja, ignorance, and restlessness. That these are the final task that is laid out before someone on the spiritual path. And the sense of I, the sense of identity, is the main protagonist that one faces. There are many other different stories. I could probably sit here all afternoon. You can see I actually have it's interesting that I happen to end up with this title for this talk, because you can probably tell I have a fondness for mythology. Actually, it was the only kind of things I read as a child. I never read like adventure stories or normal things that boys and girls read as a child, but I was buried in fairy tales and myths from the age of about four onwards. So this has always been something that has been like a main reference point for me in my life. Never really sort of conceptually worked out why, but it's always something that caught my interest. And I think that these stories work on an intuitive level, that they're there, they're absorbed, they give us models to work with. And it's interesting to see how that they arise within our own life in unexpected ways. And they present themselves, they come into our minds to give us direction. I remember a while ago someone talking to me about an experience they had. They were taken by a friend of theirs who's an artist to visit a sculpture exhibition in London. And this man says, "There's this incredible sculpture. You've got to go and see this." And it was Jacob Epstein's sculpture of Jacob wrestling the angel. And this was on exhibition in London for a while, and the monk said, "Well, come on, we're all the way down in Devon." He says, "You know, we can't just drive up to London to go and look at a piece of sculpture. That's ridiculous." He says, "You've got to see it. This is incredible. This is amazing." So this fellow was very enthused. He says, "Okay, I'll go." So anyway, this monk used to be a wrestler himself, and it's true. We have a very extraordinary variety of pasts. Yeah. I was telling someone who came to visit today, I told him that one of the nuns was just finished a PhD in nuclear physics before she came here, and another one of them used to play bass guitar in Def Leppard. It's true. I won't tell you which one. But anyway, he used to be a wrestler, this monk, and so he was dragged off to London, thinking, just basically humoring this other fellow, and he went into this exhibition. He saw the sculpture, and he was just stunned by this the sculpture. And he was describing to me the effect this had on him, because it was a very obviously like a spiritual. There was a very strong spiritual message in this, because you had the two figures, which are identical, they're physically identical to each other, except one has got wings, and the other one hasn't. So, but their bodies are identical, and they're locked together. And he was describing the hold that they were in, and he was saying that Jacob had obviously had been trying to go for this hold on the angel, whereby you get your hands under the armpits of the other person and then you flip them over, and if you can do it, it's very dramatic, and you completely defeat the opponent in one kind of glorious slam. But you have to get it just right. You have to get your balance just right, and if you can't do it, then you put your own position greatly at risk. Anyway, what you have in this statue is that Jacob has obviously been going for this hold where he was trying to flip the angel over, and he's lost it. So that Jacob's hands are underneath the angel's, and it's like he's just, the hold has just been broken, and his hands are flopped down like this. He's just lost it. And instead, the angel has got him in a bear hug. Now, a bear hug, obviously, you have to have the hands locked together to kind of crush the chest of the other person. But then he noticed that the angel, having just broken Jacob's hold, rather than the hands being locked together like that, they were fingertip to fingertip. And he realized this wasn't the angel wasn't crushing him; it was an embrace, and he was not being crushed. And so this was this had a very powerful effect on him. And then the angel is looking right towards Jacob like this, and Jacob's looking up at heaven. Like that, and it's like the moment of defeat has actually turned into the moment of embrace, where Jacob thinks he's lost. Technically, he's lost, but actually, he's the gesture between him and the angel is that of an embrace. Now, as he was telling me this story, I was thinking, well, as he started to go on about it, I began to realize began to bring up into my memory a dream that I'd had a little while before. And for years, I had a recurring dream, like a nightmare, or very vivid dreams where I would be in conflict with someone or some people. And I would always be like bashing away at some other person, or trying to knife them or shoot them or chuck rocks at them or something. And the other person would always just be standing there or sitting there, completely unbothered by the effect of what I was doing. Just sort of smiling benignly, or with that sort of look of, you know, when's he going to stop this silliness? And the sense of anxiety and fear, I've got to keep this opponent off. My life's in danger. I've got to keep them away. And this was, I could see that there was obviously something, this was indicating something to me, because of course the language of myth is the same as the language of dream. And I couldn't figure out, and this was over in recent years, I was, being a monk at the time, you think, well, what's all this violence about? You know, what is this, you know, what's going on here? I'm not a violent person, am I? You know, what's this talking about? And this dream would come back over and over again, you know, every few weeks it would return in one form or another. And this was quite disturbing to me. I couldn't figure out what it was. And then I began to think, well, who is the opponent? Who is this person, these people I keep thumping away at? And they're never the slightest bit bothered by what I'm doing to them. And they never actually retaliate. Like, I'd never get hit by them. I'd never get hurt by them in any way. But I always seemed to think that they were a terrible danger. And I couldn't figure this out at all. And then in this particular dream, it was very, very vivid. It was in color, and I was wrestling. And there was this other person I was locked together with. And then I thought, oh, it's that dream again, because it was so, it was such a clear dream that I kind of woke up in the dream. I thought, oh, it's that dream again. Now, who is this that I'm wrestling against? And then the other person kind of stood up, because we were kind of locked together, and he stood up and looked me right in the eye and smiled. And guess who it was? It was me. I thought, oh, well, if that's me, who's this? Very interesting. So then, a while later, about a year after that, then I had another dream whereby I found myself in the opposite position. That I won't go into all the details of it, but that then within this other dream, then I became the one that was being attacked. And there was this other sort of enraged figure that didn't look like me, that looked like, actually it was someone who is, he's passed away now, but he was someone who was an incredibly arrogant, conceited person. Very, very nice in other ways, but a monumental ego. And this person was in a state of rage and started to attack me. And I found myself in the position of the other protagonist, whereby, well, I let him bash away for a while, but this really isn't making any effect at all. And then, so this fellow is thrashing away, trying to hurt me, and I thought, well, this really isn't getting anywhere, I might as well leave. And I just sort of walk away and left the situation, kind of unharmed. And then when this monk was talking about this, the statue of Jacob wrestling the angel, I went and looked at the story in the Bible about Jacob and the angel, and what the whole thing seemed to symbolize, and it was quite remarkable that I'd had these dreams without ever seeing the statue or think of it in terms of Jacob and the angel. What it seemed to be was that it was the ego wrestling against the true nature of things, so the ego, the self wrestling against the Dhamma, and that no wonder that no matter how much the ego was kind of bashing away trying to protect itself, the Dhamma was neither being aggressive. That which is true and real, the natural order of things, was not being aggressive towards the ego, or was it needing to retreat? It was utterly unbothered by what the ego was doing. And that whole seeing that and witnessing in that dream then enabled me to, in a sense, contemplate it and see, well, which is the real me? And the face that I'd seen in the wrestling dream had been utterly peaceful and kind of happy and contented. And very different from the agonized, anxious, frantic person that I felt to be. And you could see that this was talking about the interplay between the identifying with the egoic mind or identifying with the dhammic or the Buddha mind, the mind which is completely attuned to nature, the transcendent knowing mind. So that sometimes, these stories that are in the air, in our blood, in our memories, just arise in this way and kind of play themselves out in the world around us. Now, this is something that say as a culture, we can really make use of, and it's not to be underestimated how bringing our attention to these different stories can really guide our lives in a very helpful way. I was very impressed reading an account of the Royal Shakespeare Company performing the works, often the tragedies of Shakespeare, in mental hospitals. There's an account of them performing King Lear in Broadmoor, which you think would be a very dangerous thing to do. But it was amazing that they'd thought to do it, and that, just as I was saying at the beginning, that the Greek theatre was very much tied up with mental health, then that what they were doing was that they were portraying the very things that these people had done, the very things that these people had, their minds were filled with, in front of their eyes. And they said that the players felt an understanding and a rapport with the audience, like they, and a commitment to the depth of their acting, far greater than they'd ever experienced before in any kind of major theatre production. That it was like the audience understood what it was about. And then they would have like discussion groups, workshops after the end of the play, whereby the players and the actors and the staff all talk with each other. And one of them said that three different people, all of whom had killed their parents, came up to them after the play and said how much they really wished that, like, I think it's Cordelia, who then, is that right? Is it Cordelia? Yeah, who makes good with at the end, how they could go to their parents and make good with them in the same kind of way. And that the way of healing the whole situation, enabling them to understand their lives. They said one or two just couldn't cope and just took themselves off and cried. But even that, in a way, just being able to let the tears out in the sense of regret and allowing it to surface is a tremendously powerful aspect of spiritual training. And in Buddhist practice, this very much relates on the internal level to what is called wise reflection, yoniso manasikara is the Pali term, whereby we bring consciously into the mind things of our life which are difficult for us, things which are hard for us to understand, things which are painful to us, things which are powerful in our minds, things which are very important to us, to be able to look at that, to raise that image up, the feeling of it, and to witness it, to acknowledge it. Because the act of attention, knowing something, is itself the healing agent. So that if we are, say, very upset about something, or very angry about something, or very depressed, or we're very excited, to be able to raise into the mind, you know, here is excitement, this is what excitement feels like, or this is a tragedy, everything has gone wrong, this is a total failure, this was a disaster. And then to be able to raise that up into the mind, and then to recognize, well, this is what disaster feels like, it's like this. And you're not pretending that it doesn't matter, but you're, by making it conscious and by bringing it up into the mind in that very clear and distinct way, then you're able to, in a sense, free the mind of it. It becomes an object. It goes away from being what I am to being part of nature. And just like the people in Broadmoor, or in listening to the different myths and legends of religious scriptures and other tales, it's, in a way, having that portrayed, brought up into consciousness in a very graphic way, enables us to digest it, enables us to say, right, well, this is part of nature. I feel it, that something has gone, I've done something terribly wrong with my life, I've made a terrible mistake, or I have a marvelous success, this is absolutely glorious, my life is fantastic. Then, having it portrayed in front of you, then you can see, well, yes, here is someone else who's had a fantastic victory, or has won all the prizes. But look what happened to them. And so one can in a way objectify the events of your life and understand them as a more comprehensive picture, rather than being swirled around like in a whirlpool, being carried around by the successes and failures, the pleasures and pains of what we experience. That we're not a victim of life, we're able to see it in a more a clear and objective way. And so this is a part of Buddhist meditation that's often neglected, but it's something that Ajahn Sumedho often teaches about, and I've derived an enormous amount from just being able to look upon your life in that way, to bring it into consciousness. And then there's a kind of portrayal in stories and in the artistic world, that this is a way that is a very powerful medium for us to bring those same things to light. And if we don't do that, what you find is that you're very ill-equipped to deal with life. It's like if you haven't done that, then when you meet tragedy, it's my tragedy. It's not just nature. If we meet with success. It's my glory. And we get carried away by it. There's a very interesting study done by a psychiatrist called Bruno Bettelheim, who did a lot of work with autistic children. And uh, he This was in the 1960s, and in the 1960s, people were very concerned with everything being politically correct and everything very kind of straight and sanitized and egalitarian. And so they started using they started to straighten up the fairy tales that they were telling the children in the hospital, the unit where they were working. So they rewrote all the fairy stories. So they took out all the ogres and the witches that ate children's heads and all the kind of ghastly and unfair and cruel and shocking elements. They kind of rewrote them. They sort of changed them and made them all sort of nice and polite. And took out all the gore. And so then they did that for quite a number of years. And then they did a... But they did that with a number of children, and there are other places, other centers that they were looking after where they didn't do that. And then about 20 years later, they did a study, like a psychological profile, on these different groups of children. And they found that the ones that had the sanitized fairy tales were much more helpless in terms of real life. They were much less able to cope. So the ones who had a full dose of dragons and gore and ogres, it's like when the boss came at them in a rage, you know, they knew, you know, reach for the magic feather. or at least they know, don't panic. Don't panic. This is, you know, there's a way out of this. And that struck me as being a very good way of understanding it. And what we have nowadays is very much in the West that we're losing our myths, or the ones that we have don't really apply in such a way, or we don't make so much of it. Because of that, we find ourselves very adrift as a society. We find ourselves very much kind of at a loss of how to steer ourselves. And there are areas of our life where we really, you know, we don't know what to do. In Asia, many of the myths are kept very much alive through classical dance and music and song and so forth. Just yesterday, I was up at an event in Leicester, and they were doing this Hindu temple. It was a conference on religious faiths and the environment, and we went to a Hindu temple there, and they did a puppet show of the Ramayana. And the woman who was narrating the story was a very gifted storyteller, and she got to the piece of the story, the Ramayana, where Rama and Sita and one of his brothers, I think, are living in the forest together, and the evil demons who are coming to try and trick them and carry Sita away, one of them appears as a golden deer in the forest, and then... suddenly, as she was talking about this golden deer, and then Sita sees the golden deer and says, "Ooh, how beautiful. Oh, I must have..." And then her voice dropped into the sound of like an Indian woman walking past a gold shop, pointing out a beautiful, beautiful necklace to her husband. She says, "Oh, I must have it. That's so beautiful." And all the women started chuckling, and the men kind of... "That's right, I've heard that one before." And you could see very easily that something that was in the tale was portraying a very everyday kind of occurrence for them. And so, you know, I find it's a shame that our culture really has lost a lot of its myths. And we do produce them, just like I was describing. I mean, our minds throw them up. And in the media, we sometimes stories that capture the imagination or people find compelling are doing just that. They're portraying where we are at as human beings or as a culture. And sometimes these can have a great effect at helping to heal or steer the society, like something like Arthur Miller's play Death of a Salesman in the 1950s really put a completely different light on the American dream. And nowadays, I was quite struck in last year when people became obsessed with the film The Silence of the Lambs. This was on everyone's tongue. Everyone was talking about it. And then when I read about what the plot of the film was, and saw the kind of fascination or obsession or horror that people had with the film, what rose in my mind was, well, this is actually a very sort of graphic portrayal. You got Western culture, Western civilization portrayed, embodied as this eloquent, polished doctor who is one who understands the body, understands the mind, and yet is completely mad and devours the very that which he is his duty and his occupation to cherish and to protect. And so this is what this is like a portrayal of where Western civilization is at. It's like a brilliant, deranged being that is devouring and despoiling the very life that it's a duty to protect. Now I don't know how one can go about creating helpful new myths or what we really need, but it struck me that what we are particularly lacking in the West, what we don't have a mythology for nowadays, or that we really need, is first of all, we don't have any spiritual heroes. You know, our heroes are all people like Arnold Schwarzenegger and Clint Eastwood and Madonna. These are the sort of the society's heroes. We don't have any spiritual heroes. Mahatma Gandhi is probably about or Martin Luther King are the latest people, but we lack any spiritual heroes. And we lack any mythology for death. Now we're death is like is life having failed. That we reject, it's a society that rejects death. We have no way of really understanding and accommodating the fact of death. And the other one that sprung to mind is that we look upon old people, elderly people, as again as young people who have failed. You're a failed, if you're old, you're a failed young person. That you're looked upon as a kind of spare part in society and are just remained. And we've lost our mythology of the old as worthy and as wise. We have lost our sense of the older generation being our sources of wisdom. I was talking yesterday with a Sikh man who came along to be a representative for the Sikh community at this conference, and he was saying how he finds that he just likes to hang out with the old people, the old members of the Sikh community, just because he just soaks up so much goodness and wisdom from them. And I thought, how rare. You know, one just doesn't find that in Western culture very much, that the old, and even elderly people themselves are so indoctrinated with this attitude, they think, well, I don't want to be a bother. You know, please put me in a home. You know, I don't want to, you know, your life is more important than mine. And you know, one understands the practicalities of it, but in a way it's a shame that we don't look upon our elders as our guides and our source of wisdom. Again, at this conference, this fellow was one of the other faiths. I won't mention the name of it, but he was saying how we really ought to look to our children and take guidance from our children. That we should put the power in the hands of the children and let them guide us. And I thought, you know, I understand that attitude, but I don't want to be around when you do it. Also, I saw what made me think of this again yesterday was in a colour supplement. There's an advertisement for the Halifax Building Society where there's this white-haired man in a leather jacket standing next to a very fancy Harley Davidson motorbike, and the headline was "Grow Old Disgracefully," and the whole idea that don't let yourself grow old. You know, fight it. You know, rage against the dying of the light. Fight old age rather than to see that oldness and that kind of wisdom and sagacity that comes from having been alive, having lived for many years, is a beautiful and worthy treasure. And that to look upon old age as just a time when you can carry on playing at childhood is a great shame. So I don't know how one can turn things around, but I see that that until we do develop a sense of or ways of generating respect and value in these areas, that our society is going to continue to drift and to wander somewhat off course. So I leave those thoughts for you to think on for this afternoon, and if you have a break for a little while, and then we can gather back together, maybe about 10:30 now.